Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. This is Valentine's Week, and I have a special Nature Now highlight, courtesy of our colleagues at BirdNote. As you heard, we have a signature opening sound. You heard it just a moment ago. In addition to the coyote, you heard the raven. The raven, of course, is seen as a trickster in many traditions, but our common ravens do have a softer side. During courtship, a pair will often sit side by side, sometimes preening each other's feathers, and during that ritual, one or both may make soft, warbling sounds. Compared to the usual raucous raven calls, this one is quite soothing. It's called a comfort call. And by the way, ravens do mate for life. Moving on, today we'll be talking with Jonathan White, an active marine conservationist, sailor, and surfer, and the author of a new book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. But first, this week's mystery sound. At the end of the show, I will share the source of this mystery sound. Now, Charlie Flashman, Nature Now's sound engineer, will help me share some of this week's observation and news.
Bruce Marston reported on the Admiralty Audubon sightings webpage that he observed an incredible aerial display of 62 black-bellied plover showing the black axillaries, or wing pits, over rolling waves near Point Hudson, with the evening setting sun spotlighting them.
And Mary Robson watched a native Douglas squirrel gather sunflower seeds from a feeder. The squirrel showed a rhythm. First, eat a stack of seeds, then carry a mouthful to bury, then come back for another batch and bury those. Eat, bury, bury. In 15 minutes, he dug three different seed hiding places. Squirrels may not be able to count, but he definitely acted as if he could. Let's hope he can retrieve those seeds before another creature finds them.
As noted on the Stardate website, Venus and Mars remain steady companions in the early evening sky this month. Venus, the evening star, is the brighter of the two, with orange Mars staying just above it.
Out on Maristone Island, Wendy Feltham watched four harlequin ducks, a male and three females. All of them were preening and seemed to be shaking off something itchy. The male duck, of course, wears a memorable pattern of rust, white, black, and teal. The female is soft browned, allowing her to be less visible when raising young. The common name comes from the comic characters in old Commedia dell'arte Italian plays. He was a servant who was decked out in silk patches of various colors. The biological name for the harlequin duck is Histrionicus histrionicus, which means overacting, overacting. It's, of course, one of the easiest bird names to remember because of the repetition.
Lastly, Ron Sykes reports that on a recent Admiralty Audubon field trip to Fort Casey on Whidbey Island, participants enjoyed seeing about 44 species, including 15 waterfowl species, at Crockett Lake. In the strait, some notable sightings were a Brandt's cormorant and four western grebe. The raptors seen included a peregrine falcon, red-tailed hawk, northern harriers, and several teenage and adult bald eagles. By the way, Ron will be Deborah Kelso's guest next week on Nature Now.
Let's go to the conversation and interview. Well, my guest today is Jonathan White. Jonathan is the author of a recently published book, Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Jonathan lives on San Juan Island, and we are speaking today by phone. Welcome, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Jonathan will actually be in Port Townsend on February the 23rd at an event sponsored by the Northwest Maritime Center. I read Jonathan's book this past weekend, and I was completely absorbed by it. I expected really solid explanations of the causes of the tides, and I expected it to be written in a way that would be very easily understandable by non-scientist readers. What I found was a book of poetic rhythms, spiritual journeys, tales of myth and magic, adventure travel, and sound science, describing the intriguing complexities of the tidal world. Let's start at the beginning, Jonathan. Will you tell listeners about the events that set you on your quest to better understand the tides?
I'd be happy to. I grew up on the California coast, and so I was a surfer and sailor and diver, and it seems like I always had a tide chart in my back pocket, you know, always consulting the tides about when the surf is best or when to dive or whatever. I built a small boat out of college. I moved up to Oregon during my teens and built a small boat, a sloop, and sailed in the Atlantic and the Caribbean and a little bit in the Pacific as well. And then in my mid-20s, I ended up buying a large, leaky wooden schooner that I found down in Tillamook Bay in Oregon. And I started a nonprofit educational organization which did seminars on the boat up and down the coast from Seattle, Southeast Alaska. I almost lost that boat to a large Alaskan tide in the mid-90s. And after that event, I realized that it was time to learn about the tide. Like I said, I'd always kept a tide chart in my back pocket, and I knew, of course, like most people, that the moon had something to do with it, but I didn't know what exactly. So I started on the journey to understand the tides, and I thought I'd read a book or two or an article, and I'd learn pretty much everything there was to learn about it. But the more I read and studied, the more fascinating and complex and poetic it became.
And your book certainly attests to all that. Most of us have an understanding that the tides are in some way linked to the moon. Can you kind of guide us along your path or a path to help us get a basic understanding of the various different forces that cause the tides?
It's an amazingly complex topic, and in fact, it's befuddled scientists ever since we started looking up at the sky. But basically, we can separate it into two different parts. One part is astronomy, I call what happens up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part is fluid dynamics, what happens down here on Earth. I think it's interesting to think about that we looked at the world very, very, very differently until just recently, until the scientific revolution just 300 years ago. And for all those years, we looked at the sky as Earth being the center of the universe and being stationary. Back then, of course, we didn't have astronomers. We had priests and astrologers, and those were the people who kept a keen eye on the heavens and tracked all the eclipses and movements of the planets and assigned divine power to those. So, in other words, they were in some ways looking for how they influenced the fate of people and people's lives. So it was a really different way to look at the universe. And we couldn't really grasp what was going on with the tides until Newton came along and his colleagues of the scientific revolution, late 17th century. So everything changed then. And what we got at that time was that the Earth was not the center of the solar system and that the Earth moved in planetary motion and gravity. Now, gravity is just as an interesting piece in all of this. In Aristotle's day, gravity was an inherent quality within the thing itself. So an apple had an inherent quality that caused it to fall to Earth. A little bit later, Kepler, in the late 17th century again, said, oh, gravity is soul. It's the soul of the universe that keeps it together. It's the soul of the apple that makes it fall to the ground. So gravity was not understood at all, and in fact wasn't even liked, because it was this very strange, mysterious, invisible, pervasive force that was kind of like black magic. So Newton very reluctantly put it right at the center of his tide theory. But it really wasn't until then that we understood that it was playing a very large role in kind of the glue of the universe. So once we got those pieces together, we could get a foothold on understanding what was going on up there that influenced the tides down here.
Help me think about the tides.
So down here.
Down here. Or up there. You can start either way.
Well, first of all, we know that the solar system is in constant motion. That means everything's moving. It's not just moving even in perfect circles or speeds and so forth. It wiggles and yaws and speeds up and slows down. And every one of those little wiggles, it actually constitutes a tide on Earth because it's a gravitational relationship that affects the oceans. We now know that there's over 400 of these.
So these are various bodies in our universe that affect a gravitational pull on the Earth. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
We think of gravity as constant, and it is. But in order to get a grasp of the tides, you have to freeze some of these relationships. Like, for example, the moon overhead is a tidal event. It's a gravitational pulse on the Earth that affects the tides. The full moon is another pulse or beat that affects the tides. The sun overhead. And there are many, many of these. Like I said, there are over 400 of these. So when it comes down to the Earth and what's happening here, that's a whole other story and equally as complex. Because if the Earth was covered with deep ocean without any continents, it would probably be fairly easy. The oceans would respond, and there'd be a wave or a bulge underneath the moon that would move around the Earth with the moon. But because there are continents, and because the oceans are not deep, the response from the moon isn't consistent, and it's very, very hard to predict.
I'm envisioning, when you talked about the Earth covered by water with no continents, and a bulge of water sort of in one direction pointing towards the moon, across the Earth 180 degrees, it's sort of, it's centripetal force. So the bulge, if you looked at it conceptually, is kind of a football shape?
That's
okay.
Right.
And so that with the Earth spinning underneath it and the moon rotating around it.
Yes, that's right.
Which is just complex enough. Anyway, keep going.
Maybe I should back up a half step here and just think about that bulge on the Earth. So, again, to simplify things, first of all, we're going to get rid of the sun. And the sun also has a tide influence, but it's about half that of the moon. And that's because the sun, while being much, much larger than the moon, it is much, much further away. So it's the moon that has the strongest influence on the Earth. So for right now, let's get rid of the sun, and let's get rid of motion. Let's say you're standing at the ferry dock at Port Townsend, and the moon is directly overhead, and it's full. Again, we're talking about an Earth that has no continent.
Right.
It's all water. You'd expect a bulge directly under that moon, because, as you mentioned, centrifugal force, there is also a bulge on the other side, directly opposite. Centrifugal force is a Latin word meaning to flee, to run away. And we know that force when we're driving around a curve and our car wants to straighten out. There's a tendency to want it to flip over off the road. That's centrifugal force, to flee away. So that bulge on the opposite side of the Earth is equal to the bulge that's underneath the moon. So now, if you're imagining all of that, let's put a little motion back into the picture. Let's say now that the Earth is doing its normal 24-hour rotation, and you're, again, at the ferry dock at Port Townsend, but 12 hours later, you've done half of that, right? You're 180 degrees away, and you're experiencing that second bulge, the centrifugal force. So that's another high tide.
Okay.
You've got a high tide at the ferry dock, and then 12 hours later, you got another high
tide. One.
And what happens in between at the six-hour intervals is you're traveling through a low tide. That's why we have two tides a day, two high tides
two highs,
and
two
low tides. However, having said that, I also want to remind you that one of the interesting things about the tides is that there are no general rules. That every time you find a rule that you think can apply everywhere, you always find exceptions. For example, Tahiti has one tide a day. And there's Ireland, a place in Ireland, has six tides a day.
And we may want to come back and explore that at a future time. Like, how does that work? Let's pause for a minute. As I mentioned, I really enjoyed your book, and I would love it if you would read just a brief selection from it.
I'd be happy to. This is from the introduction. Before Newton introduced gravity in a unified picture of planetary motion, the ancients put forth tide theories based on myth, astrology, practical observations, and religious beliefs. They used the conceptual tools they had, as we do today, to make sense of their world. The Maori of New Zealand believed the tides rose and fell at the whim of a woman god who lived on the moon. In many cultures, there was a perceived secret harmony between the tide and human life. Flooding tides were a time of exuberance, prosperity, conception, birth. It was a time to make butter and sow clover. Ebbing tides were a time of melancholy, harvest, death. A woman's menstrual cycle was a tide's ebb and flow within her body. The tide's long inhale and exhale is suggestive of a living being. Some thought the tides were the breathing of Gaia, the earth itself, and others suspected it was a large beast. Leonardo da Vinci was convinced of the latter and tried to calculate the size of its lung. Whatever speculation about the tide's cause or secret harmony, the earliest coastal people most certainly accumulated vast practical knowledge about tide patterns. They needed this information to survive, to know where and when to pick mussels or gather seaweed in the intertidal, when to launch a boat, and how to take advantage of currents. We all know that you only need to paddle against the tide once to be convinced never to try it again. From a practical point of view, it didn't matter if the tide was caused by a beast or a god. It only mattered that daily survival was easier if you observed the tide and worked with it, not against it. The more you knew, the better. I learned a little bit about the depth of indigenous knowledge when I went hunting several years ago with Lucas E. Napaluk, an Inuit elder from the Arctic Canada. We had hiked across a tundra toward Hudson Strait, where we planned to launch a small boat. As we approached the shore, I guessed that the tide was mid-range. "It's flooding," Lucas E. said. It was a quiet beach, and to my eye, there was no indication whether the tide was flooding or ebbing. "How do you know?" I asked. "Fuzz," he answered. He would have left it at that, but I persisted. "What fuzz?" "When the tide is flooding," he said, "it picks up dust and pollen and insect larvae from the beach. That sits on top of the water like a blanket. It doesn't happen when the tide is dropping." For Lucas E., the fuzz tells him which way the currents are moving, how fast, and for how long. It tells him when to launch his boat and what course to steer. It tells him whether he should round Point Frontenac looking for seals or head for Cape Neptune to fish for char. Today, I notice fuzz around Washington State's San Juan Islands where I live. I see it from my car as I drive in the late afternoon. It looks like velvet.
Wow. I am going to have to look for fuzz.
Yep.
I can also see that there are many, many things that we really want to talk about. The notion of mythology and the weird things that tides do. Give me a couple of weird things that tides do or weird facts about tides.
Well, one of them is that water wells, even inland water wells in the Midwest, Wisconsin, produce more water during flood tide than during ebb tide.
So that's the pull of the gravity again, right?
That's right. You want one more?
Sure.
Tide creates friction, lots of it, by rubbing against the ocean floor. And some of that's dispersed as heat, just like when you rub your hands together. But most of it is transferred into energy that acts as a brake on the Earth's rotation. So by a very small amount per day, the Earth is turning slower and the days are growing longer, because of the tide.
Okay, we're going to have to come back to that one, too. So I can see conversations about the mythology around it, about this notion of tides and time, more about, actually, let's introduce continents and what do the tides look like around the Salish Sea. So you will come back, won't you?
I'd love to.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Well, that was fun, and I'm certainly looking forward to talking with Jonathan about a whole host of things tidal. But let's listen to that mystery sound again. That was the roar and turmoil of a tidal bore. A tidal bore is a special and often quite large wave that under certain conditions travels up a river. We'll be talking more about bores, the tidal kind, of course, in our next conversation with Jonathan. Let's look forward at upcoming events. Charlie.
The Northwest Straits Foundation is co-sponsoring today's guest, Jonathan White, at several book reading and signing events. On Tuesday, February 21st, catch up with Jonathan at the Village Bookstore in Bellingham. And on Thursday, February 23rd, Jonathan will be at the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend for a talk complete with photographs, stories, and short readings. Jonathan will take his audiences on an enthralling journey into the surprising and poetic workings of the tide.
And there are two more places that Jonathan's going to be. He'll be in Port Angeles at the library the evening of February the 24th. And in Bainbridge Island at the Eagle Harbor Bookstore the evening of February the 16th. Well, two fun photographic events are coming up. On February the 15th, join members of the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society at the Dungeness River Audubon Center in Sequim for photo night. And on Thursday, February the 16th, join members of the Admiralty Audubon Society for a photographic show at the Port Townsend Community Center. Professional photographer Alan L. Bauer will share an image-intensive celebration of our world.
We have been hearing a lot about the plight of native bees these past few years. Bumblebees hold importance for pollination because they work from early spring and endure cold, damp weather. Their decline is, in part, because colonies of non-native bumblebees are trucked around for agricultural pollination. If you want to join a citizen science project to monitor bumblebee populations, check with the Xerces Society. They have been managing this project for about 3 years and can use recruits. Check the Xerces, X-E-R-C-E-S, Society website for fascinating details.
And the Native Plant Society will explore the ecology of the sagebrush steppe with Varn Brooks and provide an update on their protection and restoration projects at Katai Prairie and Point Wilson. Join them the evening of Tuesday, February the 21st at Port Townsend Community Center. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Frank Sinatra singing Ebb Tide.
Then rolls out to sea, and the sea is very still once more. So I rush to your side like the oncoming tide, with one burning thought, will your arms open wide?